a person who wants your money to grow with the least possible effort, and you just don't care about all the theory, you can skip ahead to a section called Target Date Funds, Investing the Easy Way. There you'll find a step-by-step guide for picking a single investment, a target date fund, and you'll get started investing in just a few hours. But if you're a type A nerd like me, who wants to learn how it all works, and maybe even customize your portfolio for more control, then keep listening. I'll walk you through the building blocks of a portfolio, and I'll help you construct one that's both aggressive and balanced. Investing is not about picking stocks. Really, it's not. Ask your friends what they think investing means, and I bet you they'll say picking stocks. Guys, you cannot reliably pick stocks that will outperform the markets over the long term. It's way too easy to make mistakes, such as being overconfident about choices or panicking when your investments drop even a little. As we heard in Chapter 6, even experts can't guess what will happen to the stock market. But because they've heard it repeatedly from the many investment blogs and YouTube videos, people think investing is about picking stocks and that anyone can be successful. Well, they can't. I hate to say it, but not everyone is a winner. In fact, most of these so-called financial experts are failures. Anyway, a little known fact is that the major predictor of your portfolio's volatility doesn't stem from the individual stocks you pick, as most people think, but instead from your mix of stocks and bonds. In 1986, researchers Gary Brinson, Randolph Hood, and Gilbert Bebauer published a study in Financial Analyst Journal that rocked the financial world. They demonstrated that more than 90% of your portfolio's volatility is a result of your asset allocation. I know, asset allocation sounds like some BS phrase, like mission statement or strategic alliance, but it's not. Asset allocation is your plan for investing. That's the way you distribute your investments in your portfolio between stocks, bonds, and cash. In other words, by diversifying your investments across different asset classes, like stocks and bonds, or better yet, stock funds and bond funds, you can control the risk in your portfolio and therefore control how much money you'll lose on average due to volatility. It turns out that the way you allocate your portfolio, whether it's 100% stocks or 90% stocks and 10% bonds, makes a profound difference on your returns. Later, other researchers tried to measure how closely volatility and returns were correlated, but the answer ends up being pretty complicated. Suffice it to say that asset allocation is the most significant part of your portfolio that you can control. Think about that remarkable fact. Your investment plan is more important than your actual investments. Take, for example, this book. If we apply the same principle here, it means that the way I organize this book, my table of contents, is more important than any given word in it. That actually makes intuitive sense, right? Well, the same is true of investing. If you allocate your money properly, for example, not all in one stock, but spread out across different types of funds, you won't have to worry about a single stock possibly cutting your portfolio's value in half. In fact, by diversifying your investments, you'll make more money as an individual investor. To know how to allocate your assets, you have to know the basic options you have for investing, which is where we're headed next. William Bernstein, the author of The Four Pillars of Investing, Lessons for Building a Winning Portfolio, wrote, "Since you cannot successfully time the market or select individual stocks, asset allocation should be the major focus of your investment strategy. Because it is the only factor affecting your investment risk and return that you can control." The building blocks of investing. If you're not interested in the mechanics of investing and you want to skip ahead to learn what the simplest investment choice is, go ahead and skip ahead to the section on target date funds. But if you want to know more about what's going on under the hood, stick with me. I want to describe to you something called the pyramid of investing. It represents all the possible choices for different investments. At the bottom of this pyramid is the most basic level, where you can invest in stocks or bonds or just hold your money in cash. Now, I'm oversimplifying because there are tons of different kinds of stocks and bonds, but you get the idea. Above them are index funds and mutual funds. And finally, at the top of the pyramid are target date funds. Let's look at each category of investment, also known as asset classes, to see what lies beneath. Stocks. When you buy stocks, you buy shares of a company. If the company does well, you expect your stock to do well. When people talk about the market, they're usually referring to an index of stocks, like the Dow Jones, which is 30 large cap stocks, or the S&P 500. That's 500 companies with large market capitalization. Investment nerds might be wondering, what's the difference between the indexes? Well, there are lots of differences, but in general, they're not really important to your personal finances. Each index is like a college. There are committees that determine the criteria for allowing companies on their index, and they may change those criteria over time. Overall, stocks as a category provide excellent returns. As we know, on average, the stock market returns about 8% per year. In fact, you can do significantly better than the market if you pick a winning stock, or significantly worse if you pick a loser. Although stocks as a whole provide generally excellent returns over time, individual stocks are less clear. If you invest all your money in one stock, for example, you might make a huge return, but it's also possible the company could tank and you could lose it all. Stocks have been a good way to earn significant returns over the long term, but I discourage you from picking individual stocks because it's really, really difficult to choose winning ones on your own. The tricky thing about stocks is you never know what'll happen. For example, in 2018, Snapchat announced a redesign of their app interface. The stock plunged 9.5% in one day. And of course, the opposite can happen if a company announces good news. In Chapter 6, I demonstrated that even professionals whose livelihoods depend on it cannot predict stock returns. And remember, these are highly trained analysts who can read stock prospectuses like I can read an Indian restaurant menu, flawlessly. If these experts, who devour annual reports and understand complicated balance sheets, can't beat the market, what chance do you have of picking stocks that'll go up? Well, the answer is you have very little chance. That's why individual investors like you and me should not invest in individual stocks. Instead, we'll choose funds, which are collections of stocks, and sometimes for diversification, bonds. They'll let you reduce your risk and create a well-balanced portfolio that will let you sleep well at night. But more on that later. Bonds. Bonds are essentially IOUs from companies or the government. And technically, bonds are longer-term investments of 10-plus years, whereas certificates of deposit, or CDs, involve lending money to a bank. Because they're pretty similar, let's just call them both bonds to simplify things. If you buy a one-year bond, it's the same as if the bank says, hey, if you lend us $100, I'll give you back $103 a year from now. The advantages of bonds are that you can choose the term or length of time that you want the loan to last. For example, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, and so on. And you know exactly how much you'll get when they mature or pay out. Also, bonds, especially government bonds, are generally stable and let you decrease the risk in your portfolio. See, the only way you'd lose money on a government bond is if the government defaulted on its loans. And it doesn't do that. If it runs low on money, it just prints more of it. Now that is gangster. Because bonds are such a safe, low-risk investment, the return, even on a highly rated bond, is much lower than it would be on an excellent stock. Investing in bonds also renders your money illiquid, meaning it's locked away and inaccessible for a set period of time. Technically, you can withdraw early, but you'll face severe penalties, so it's a bad idea. With these qualities, what kind of person would invest in bonds? Any ideas? Let's see here. Extremely stable, essentially guaranteed rate of return, but relatively small returns. Who do you think would do it? Well, the answer is, in general, rich people and old people like bonds. Old people like them because they want to know exactly how much money they're getting next month for their medication or whatever it is they need. Also, some of these grannies and grandpas can't withstand the volatility of the stock market because they don't have very much other income to support themselves, or they have very little time left on this earth to recover from any downturns. Now, this has become very morbid, but hey, this is one category of people who use bonds. Rich people, on the other hand, tend to become more conservative because they have so much money. Put it this way, when you have $10,000, you want to invest aggressively to grow it, because you want to make more money. But when you have $10 million, your goals switch from aggressive growth to something called preservation of capital. Chuck Jaffe once wrote a CBS MarketWatch column where he shared this old story about Groucho Marx, the famous comedian and avid investor. One trader said, "Hey, Groucho, where do you invest your money?" He said, "I keep my money in treasury bonds." And they said, "That doesn't make you much money." He replied, "They do if you have enough of them." If you have a lot of money, you will accept lower investment returns in exchange for security and safety. So a guaranteed bond at 3% or 4% is attractive to a wealthy person. After all, 3% of 10 million is still a lot. Cash. In investing terms, cash is money that's sitting on the sidelines, uninvested, and earning only a little bit in interest from money market accounts, which are basically high-interest savings accounts. Traditionally, cash has been the third part of a portfolio alongside stocks and bonds. You want to have totally liquid cash on hand for emergencies and as a hedge if the market tanks. Of course, you pay a price for this security. Cash is the safest part of your portfolio, but it also offers the lowest reward. In fact, you actually lose money by holding cash once you factor inflation in. That's why I say it's traditionally been part of a portfolio. As long as you're contributing towards your savings goals, as I described in Chapter 5, and you have enough to cover emergencies, and ideally more, you're fine. You don't have to worry about having cash in your investment account. Let's keep this simple. Asset allocation, the critical factor that most investors miss. If you bought all different kinds of stocks or stock funds, you'd be diversified, but still only within stocks. That's like being the hottest person in Friendship, Wisconsin. It's nice, but we're talking about modest competition here. By the way, Friendship is actually a real place. My friend grew up there, and he told me what he and his buddies used to use as a gang sign. Two hands clasping in friendship. It's important to diversify within stocks, but it's even more important to allocate across the different asset classes, like stocks and bonds. Investing in only one category is dangerous over the long term. And this is where the all-important concept of asset allocation comes into play. Here's a good little mnemonic trick to remember this. Diversification is D for going deep on a category. For example, buying different types of stocks, like large cap, small cap, international, and so on. And asset allocation is A for going across all categories. For example, stocks and bonds. This is the kind of fun stuff that personal finance people come up with on their time off. Cool, right? In determining where to allocate your assets, one of the most important considerations is what returns each category offers. Of course, based on the different types of investments you make, you can expect different returns. For example, higher risk generally equals higher potential for reward. Let me give you an example. NYU professor DeMoterin analyzed 90 years of investment returns, and his numbers show us the returns of different categories. Let's start with stocks. Over 90 years, in general, these higher risk investments returned 11.5%. Bonds, which are lower risk, returned approximately 5.2%. And cash, which is ultra low risk, returned 3.4%. So, at first glance, it seems clear that stocks return the most. So their natural tendency is to say, let's put all our money there. But not so fast. Remember, higher reward entails higher risk. So if you're loaded up on stocks and your portfolio dips 35% next year, all of a sudden, you're financially immobile, you're only eating Triscuits, and you're waiting to see if your money climbs back up or you die first. Your asset allocation is actually one of the most important decisions you will make in life. It's a decision that could be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars to you, or for some of you, millions. But in a peculiar quirk of human nature, we're more likely to talk about a new restaurant or some TV show rather than our asset allocation. In fact, how many of us have never even heard the phrase asset allocation before? That's because the financial media thinks it's too complicated for us to understand. So they resort to words like safety and growth. In reality, asset allocation is one of the only things that matters, and I think you're smart enough to learn it. Asset allocation has real-world consequences. For example, many of us have heard of 50- and 60-year-olds who saw catastrophic drops in their portfolios during the last recession. Well, the truth is, their assets were not properly allocated. They never should have invested in all equities, nor should they have sold during the downturn. In fact, had they stayed in the market, they would have been handsomely rewarded over time. Age and risk tolerance matter. If you're 25 years old and you have dozens and dozens of years to grow your money, a portfolio made of mostly stock-based funds probably makes sense. But if you're older, retirement is coming up sooner and you'll want to tamp down your risk. Even if the market tanks, you have control over your asset allocation. If you're older, especially if you're in your 60s or older, a sizable portion of your portfolio should be in stable bonds. Bonds act as a counterweight to stocks, generally rising when stocks fall and reducing the overall risk of your portfolio. By investing part of your money in bonds, you reduce some of your overall risk. Sure, if that biotech stock went up 200%, you'd wish your bond money was all in that stock. But if the stock went down, you'll be glad your bonds were there as a buffer against losing everything. Although it may seem counterintuitive, your portfolio will actually have better overall performance if you add bonds to the mix. Because bonds will generally perform better when stocks fall, bonds lower your risk a lot while limiting your returns only a little. Now, I know it's common to say, but Ramit, I'm young, I want to invest aggressively, I don't need bonds. Well, I agree, bonds aren't really for young people in their 20s. If you're in your 20s or early 30s and you don't necessarily need to reduce your risk, you can simply invest in all stock funds and let time mitigate any risk. But in your 30s and older, you'll want to begin balancing your portfolio with bonds to reduce risk. And what if stocks as a whole don't perform well for a long time? Well, that's when you need to own bonds to offset the bad times. Another interesting scenario calls for lower risk via bonds. That is, if you've accumulated a very large portfolio, then you have a very different risk profile. In one famous example, personal finance expert Susie Orman was asked about her net worth in an interview. She replied, "One journalist estimated my liquid net worth at $25 million. That's pretty close. My houses are worth another $7 million." The journalist then asked where she puts her money. With the exception of $1 million in the stock market, she said, the rest was in bonds. The personal finance world was horrified. All that money in bonds? But guess what? She has approximately 25 million good reasons that other people don't. As a financial advisor once told me, once you've won the game, there's no reason to take unnecessary risk. Stocks and bonds have many flavors. Let me walk you through some different types of stocks and bonds in case you're interested in wondering all the different options that you possibly have. Large cap stocks. These are big companies with a market capitalization over $10 billion. Mid cap stocks. These are mid-sized companies with a market cap between $1 billion and $5 billion. Small cap stocks. Smaller companies with a market cap of less than $1 billion. International investments. These are stocks from companies in other countries, including emerging markets like China and India, and developed markets like the UK and Germany. Americans may sometimes buy these directly, but they may have to buy them through funds. Growth stocks. These are stocks whose value may grow higher than other stocks or even the market as a whole. Value stocks. These are stocks that seem bargain price. In other words, they seem cheaper than they should be. Now let's talk about bonds. Government bonds are an ultra-safe investment that's backed by the government. In exchange for their low risk, government bonds tend to return less than stocks. Corporate bonds are bonds issued by corporations. These tend to be riskier than government bonds, but safer than stocks. Short-term bonds are bonds with terms of usually less than 3 years. Long-term bonds tend to mature in 10 or more years and accordingly offer higher yields than shorter-term bonds. Municipal bonds, also known as munis, these are bonds offered by local governments. And inflation-protected bonds are Treasury inflation-protected securities, or TIPS. These are ultra-safe investments that protect against inflation. The importance of being diversified. Now that we know the basics of the asset classes, stocks, bonds, and cash, which are at the bottom of the pyramid, let's explore the different choices within each asset class. Basically, there are many types of stocks, and we need to own a little of all of them. Same with bonds. This is called diversifying, and it essentially means digging into each asset class, stocks and bonds, and investing in all their subcategories. As I discussed, the broad category of stocks actually includes lots of different kinds of stocks, like large company stocks, large cap, mid-cap stocks, small cap stocks, and international stocks. To add yet another wrinkle, none of them performs consistently. In the same year, small cap stocks might gain huge percentages, but international stocks might tank. And this performance can vary from year to year. Similarly, different types of bonds offer different benefits, including different rates of return and tax advantages. In his 2012 book, Skating Where the Puck Was, William Bernstein says to resign yourself to the fact that diversifying yourself among risky assets provides scant shelter from bad days or bad years, but that it does help protect against bad decades and generations, which can be far more destructive to wealth. Diversification is about safety in the long term. The fact that performance varies so much in each asset class means two things. First, if you're trying to make a quick buck off investing, you'll usually lose money because you have no idea what'll happen in the near-term future. Anyone who tells you they do is a fool or a commission-based salesman. Second, you should own different categories of stocks and maybe bonds to balance out your portfolio. You don't want to own only U.S. small cap stocks, for example, or funds that own only U.S. small cap stocks. If they didn't perform well for 10 years, that would really suck. If, however, you own small cap stocks, plus large cap stocks, plus international stocks, and more, you're effectively insured against any one area dragging you down. So if you were to invest in stocks, you'd want to diversify, buying all different types of stocks or stock funds to have a balanced portfolio. These allocations are just general rules of thumb. Some people prefer to have 100% in stocks until they're in their 30s or 40s. Others are more conservative and want some money in bonds. But the big takeaway here is that if we're in our 20s and 30s, we can afford to be aggressive about investing in stocks and stock funds, even if they drop temporarily, because time is on our side. And honestly, if you're nervous about investing and just starting out, your biggest danger isn't having a portfolio that's too risky. It's being lazy and overwhelmed and not doing anything at all. That's why it's important to understand the basics, but not get too wrapped up in all the variables and choices. Over time, you can manage your asset allocation to reduce risk and get a fairly predictable return on investments. 30 years from now, you're going to need to invest very differently than you do today. That's just natural. You invest much more aggressively in your 30s than in your 60s, when you find yourself growing older and telling long-winded stories about how you trudge through 3 miles of snow each way to get to school each morning. The real work in investing comes with creating an investment plan that's appropriate for your age and comfort levels with risk. All this sounds completely reasonable, right? I invest aggressively when I'm younger, and as I get older, I get more conservative. There's just one problem. How the hell are you supposed to do this? What specific investment should you choose? Should you invest in individual stocks? No. Most people just stop here, thinking that investing is only about stocks. Not surprisingly, when they try to think more deeply about this, they get confused and delay the decision to invest until someday in the future. Do not let this happen to you. Let's go up the pyramid of investing options to cover another key to investing: funds. What a granny needs: typical asset allocations by age. Here's what typical asset allocations might look like as investors get older. Remember, asset allocation is the mix of different investments in your portfolio. These figures are taken from Vanguard's target date funds. At 35 years old, a typical asset allocation might look like 90% stocks and 10% bonds. At 45 years old, same thing, 90% stocks, 10% bonds. At 55 years old, 69% stocks and 31% bonds. You can see that that portfolio gets more conservative. And finally, at 65 years old, 53% stocks and 47% bonds, even more conservative. Mutual funds. Not bad, pretty convenient, but often expensive and unreliable. The financial industry isn't stupid. These people are ingenious at creating products to meet investor needs, or what the industry wants people to need. In 1924, mutual funds, which are just baskets filled with different types of investments, usually stocks, were invented. Instead of requiring investors to perform the Herculean task of picking individual stocks themselves, mutual funds allowed average investors to simply choose different types of funds that would suit them. For example, there are large cap, mid cap, and small cap stock mutual funds, but also mutual funds that focus on biotech, communication, and even European and Asian stocks. Mutual funds are extremely popular because they allow you to pick one fund that contains different stocks and not worry about putting too many eggs in one basket, or monitoring prospectuses, or keeping up with industry news. The funds provide instant diversification because they hold many different stocks. Now, most people's first encounter with mutual funds is through their 401k, where they choose from a bewildering array of options. You buy shares of the fund, and the fund's manager picks the stocks he or she thinks will yield the best return. Mutual funds are incredibly useful financial tools. Over the past 85 years, they've proven to be very popular and extremely profitable. Compared with other investments, they've been a steady cash cow for Wall Street. That's because in exchange for active management, which is having an expert choose a fund's stocks, the financial companies charge big fat fees, also known as expense ratios. These fees eat a hole in your return. For what? For nothing. You don't need to pay that. Sure, there are some low-fee fund options out there, but most mutual funds have high expense ratios. Now, I don't fault the financial companies for selling mutual funds. They got average Americans to invest, and even after fees, mutual funds are an excellent investment choice compared with doing nothing. But guess what? Things have changed. As we heard in Chapter 6, there are now better options for investing, lower cost, better performing index funds. Advantages of a mutual fund. Hands-off approach means an expert money manager makes investment decisions for you. Mutual funds hold many varied stocks, so if one company tanks, your fund doesn't go down with it. Disadvantages. Annual fees can equal tens of thousands of dollars or more over the lifetime of an investment by using expense ratios, front-end loads, and back-end loads. Those are all worthless sales charges that add nothing to your returns. Also, if you invest in two mutual funds, they might overlap in investments, meaning you're not really as diversified as you think. Worst of all, you're paying an expert to manage your money, and 75% of them don't even beat the market. In short, mutual funds are prevalent because of their convenience, but because these actively managed mutual funds are expensive, they're not the best investment anymore. Active management can't compete with passive management, which takes us to index funds, the more attractive cousin of mutual funds. Anand Trivedi, who's 35 years old, wrote, "I put my first chunk of money in an actively managed fund about a year before I read your book and really began to understand mutual funds. It was a long-term investment, so it certainly made money, but when compared to a benchmark index fund, I missed out on some growth. I finally found myself at a point where paying capital gains tax made sense, so I've now been able to roll it into lower cost investments. Thanks, Ramit, for showing us the light." Index funds, the attractive cousin in an otherwise unattractive family. In 1975, John Bogle, the founder of Vanguard, introduced the world's first index fund. These simple funds buy stocks and match the market versus the traditional mutual fund, which employs an expensive staff of experts who try to predict which stocks will perform well. They trade frequently, incurring taxes in the process and charging you fees. In short, they charge you to lose. Index funds set a much lower bar. No experts, no attempt to beat the market, just a computer that automatically attempts to match the index and keep costs low for you. Index funds are the financial equivalent of, if you can't beat them, join them. and they do so while also being low cost and tax efficient and requiring hardly any maintenance at all. In other words, index funds are simply collections of stocks that computers manage in an effort to match the index of the market. There are index funds for the S&P 500, for Asia Pacific funds, for real estate funds, and for anything else you can imagine. Just like mutual funds, they have ticker symbols, such as VFINX. Bogle argued that index funds would offer better performance to individual investors. Active mutual fund managers could not typically beat the market, yet they charged investors unnecessary fees. There's a funny effect called illusory superiority, which refers to how we all think we're better than other people, especially Americans. For example, in one study, 93% of respondents rated themselves in the top 50% of driver skills, an obviously impossible number. We believe that we have a better memory and that we're kinder and more popular and more unbiased than others. It feels good to believe it, yet psychology has shown us that we are flawed. Once you understand this, Wall Street makes a lot more sense. Every mutual fund manager believes he can beat the market. To accomplish this, managers use fancy analysis and data, and they trade frequently. Ironically, this results in lots of taxes and trading fees, which, when combined with expense ratios, makes it virtually impossible for the average fund investor to beat or even match the market over time. Bogle opted to discard the old model of mutual funds and introduce index funds. Today, index funds are an easy, efficient way to make a significant amount of money. Note, however, that index funds simply match the market. If you own all equities in your 20s and 30s and the stock market drops, like it has from time to time, and it will from time to time, your investments will drop. Expect it. It's normal for your investments to go up and down. High expense ratios cost you more than you think. Let's talk about the difference between how much your fees will cost you as your portfolio grows. Let's say you're starting out and after a year or two of investing, you have $5,000 in your portfolio. If you're paying for a low-cost index fund with annual expenses of 0.14%, you're paying about $7 in annual expenses. Now, if you're paying the annual expenses of an actively managed mutual fund, which charges 1%, you're paying $50. Now, with $5,000 in your portfolio, $7 versus $50, not that big of a deal. But let's fast forward until later in life. Now you have $1 million in your portfolio. If you are paying for an index fund with 0.14% expenses, your annual expenses will be $1,400. What if you're paying for a 1% fee for an actively managed mutual fund? Guess how much that costs you? That's $10,000. High expense ratios cost you way more than you think. Over the long term, the stock market has always gone up. As a bonus for using index funds, you'll anger your friends in finance because you'll be throwing up the middle finger to the entire industry, and you'll keep their fat fees for yourself. Wall Street is terrified of index funds and tries to keep them under wraps by marketing mutual funds and nonsense like five-star funds. Advantages: extremely low cost, easy to maintain, and tax efficient. Disadvantages: when you're investing in index funds, you typically have to invest in multiple funds to create a comprehensive asset allocation. Although owning one is better than doing nothing. If you do purchase multiple index funds, you'll have to rebalance or adjust your investments to maintain your target asset allocation. And you'll have to do this regularly, about once every 12 to 18 months. Also, each fund typically requires a minimum investment, though this is often waived with automatic monthly investments. Okay, so here's what we know. Index funds are clearly far superior to buying either individual stocks and bonds or mutual funds. With their low fees, they're a great choice if you want to create and control the exact makeup of your portfolio. But what if you're one of those people who knows you'll never get around to doing the necessary research to figure out an appropriate asset allocation? Let's be honest, most people do not want to construct a diversified portfolio, and they certainly don't want to rebalance and monitor their funds, even if it's just once a year. If you fall into this group, which is frankly 99.999% of people, there's an option at the very top of the investment pyramid. It's an investment option that I love, and it's one that is drop-dead easy. It's called Target Date Funds. Target Date Funds, investing the easy way. Whether you're just arriving here directly from earlier in this chapter, or you've listened all the way through the basics of investing and decided, hey, after all, I do want to take the easy way out, Target Date Funds are the easiest investment choice you'll ever need to make. Target Date Funds are my favorite investment of all because they embody the 85% solution. Not exactly perfect, but easy enough for anyone to get started. And they work just fine. Target Date Funds are simple funds that automatically diversify your investments for you based on when you plan to retire. Let's assume, through the rest of this book, that you will retire at 65. Instead of you having to rebalance stocks and bonds, Target Date Funds do it for you. If more Americans owned Target Date Funds, for example, during the last recession, far fewer retirees would have seen precipitous drops in their retirement accounts. Why? Because the Target Date Funds would have automatically changed their portfolio to a more conservative asset allocation as they approach their golden years. Target Date Funds are actually fund of funds, or collections made up of other funds, which offer automatic diversification. For example, a Target Date Fund might include large cap, mid cap, small cap, and international funds. And those funds, in turn, will hold stocks for each of those areas. In other words, your Target Date Fund will own many funds, all of which own stocks and bonds. It sounds complicated, but believe it or not, this actually makes things simple for you, because all you have to do is own one fund, and all the rest is taken care of for you. Target Date Funds are different from index funds, which are also low cost, but those index funds require you to own multiple different index funds if you want a full comprehensive asset allocation. Multiple funds mean that you have to rebalance your funds regularly, usually every 12 to 18 months, which is laborious. Who really wants to sit around and reallocate money and rebalance it? What a pain. Luckily, Target Date Funds automatically pick a blend of investments for you based on your approximate age. They start you off with aggressive investment in your 20s and then shift investments to become more conservative as you get older. And for you? Well, you do no work except continuing to send money into your Target Date Fund regularly. Now, Target Date Funds aren't perfect for everyone because they work on one variable alone. That is when you plan to retire. If you had unlimited resources, if you had more time, more money, more discipline, you could conceivably squeeze out slightly better returns by building a custom portfolio based on your exact needs. But while we all grew up with our parents telling us we were special and different, the truth is that most of us are mostly the same. And very few of us have the resources or desire to constantly monitor our portfolios. That's why I really like Target Date Funds. They're designed to appeal to people who are lazy. In other words, for many people, the ease of use of these funds far outweighs any minor loss of returns that might occur from taking a one-size-fits-all approach. In my opinion, if that means it'll get you investing, then the benefits of having one fund that handles all your investments makes up for any possible shortcomings. Target Date Funds aren't all created equal. Some of them are more expensive than others, but as a general rule, they're low cost and tax efficient. Best of all, they take no work beyond automatically contributing money once a month, once a quarter, or once a year. You won't have to actively invest, you won't have to actively monitor, and you won't have to actively rebalance on your own because Target Date Funds handle all the messy work for you. I love it. One thing to note is that you'll need between $100 and $1,000 as a minimum to buy into a fund. If you don't have it, set a savings goal. And once you save the minimum needed to invest, you can open your fund and set up an automatic transfer each month. I cannot recommend Target Date Funds enough. They're easy, low cost, and they simply work. Karen Dudek Brannon, 37 years old, wrote, "The most beneficial part of the book for me was the section that explained the basics of what you really need in a retirement account. and the 85% solution that helps you get your investments good enough so you're not stressing out about which type of fund to choose. I like the idea that taking action and picking some type of basic life cycle target date fund is better than getting stuck in analysis paralysis and not saving. Professionals agree, index funds are great investments. You don't have to take my word for it. Here are a few experts on the benefits of index funds. Warren Buffett, one of America's greatest investors, says, "I believe that 98 or 99%, maybe more than 99% of people who invest should extensively diversify and not trade. That leads them to an index fund with very low costs." Mark Hulbert, former editor of Hulbert Financial Digest, wrote, "When you realize how few advisors have beaten the market over the last several decades, you may acquire the discipline to do something even better. Become a long-term index fund investor." And W. Scott Simon, author of Index Mutual Funds, Profiting from an Investment Revolution, writes, "The media focuses on the temporarily winning active funds that score the more spectacular bullseyes, not index funds that score every year and accumulate less flashy but ultimately winning scores." Choosing and actually buying your investments. By now, you should know what you want to invest in: a target date fund or index funds. If you're even thinking about buying individual stocks because it sounds sexy or you think you can beat the market, do me a favor. Just go to your kitchen, get a big Ziploc bag, take all your money and put it in there, and just light it on fire. Why don't you just skip the middleman and cut right to it? Now, if you don't want to spend a billion years managing your money, and you're satisfied with the 85% solution of investing in a convenient fund that's good enough and it'll free you up to live your life and do what you love, then go for the target date fund. If you are a hardcore personal finance geek and you're willing to spend time on your investments, you want to rebalance every single year, you want more control, then choose index funds. Whichever category you fall into, you'll want to figure out exactly what to invest in. So let's get started. A common investment option: your 401k. As we discussed in Chapter 3, if you get a 401k match from your employer, you need to pay into your 401k before you do any other investing. If your employer doesn't offer a 401k match, skip to the Roth IRA section. You should have already set up your 401k, so now it's time to focus on how you allocate the money that you're contributing to your 401k. By the way, if you had to pick funds when you opened your account, you can always go back in and change your allocation. Just ask your HR person for the proper form, or better yet, change it directly on the 401k website. You know how I love reducing choice to get people to take action? Well, the companies that offer 401ks take this to an extreme. They offer a few investment options for you to choose from. Usually the options are called something like aggressive investments, which is usually a fund of mostly stocks, balanced investments — this fund will contain stocks and bonds — and conservative investments, a more conservative mix of mostly bonds. If you're not sure what the different choices mean, ask your HR rep for a sheet describing the difference in funds. And I want you to pay attention to this. Stay away from money market funds, which is just another way of saying your money is sitting uninvested in cash. You want your money working for you. As a young person, I encourage you to pick the most aggressive fund that you're comfortable with. As you know, the more aggressive you are when you're younger, the more money you'll have later in life. And this is especially true for a 401k, which is an ultra long-term investment account. Depending on what company your employer uses to administer your 401k, your fund options might be a little pricey in terms of the expense ratio. As a side note, I consider anything above 0.5 or 0.75% expensive. But on balance, you're still getting huge tax advantages and hopefully employer match benefits. So it's worth it to invest in these funds, even if they aren't perfect. Investing using your Roth IRA. After your 401k match, the next best place to invest is in your Roth IRA. I want to remind you again that in addition to accruing earnings tax-free, one of the primary benefits of Roth IRAs is the flexibility of choosing any fund you want. When you send money to your Roth IRA account, it just sits there. You're going to need to invest the money to start making good returns. Now, the easiest investment is a target date fund. You can just buy it, set up automatic monthly contributions, and then forget about it. Choosing a target date fund for your Roth IRA. Let's assume you're looking for a target date fund through Vanguard, which I recommend, although there are plenty of other solid companies that offer target date funds. You'll notice that Vanguard offers funds with names like Target Retirement 2040, Target Retirement 2045, and Target Retirement 2050. So what's the difference here? Well, the main difference among these funds is how they're allocated. The larger the number, which represents the year you'll retire, the more equities, also known as stocks, that the fund has. To find the right fund, all you need to know is choose the year you're likely to retire. If, like most people, you're thinking about age 65, look up the fund that's closest to that year for you. For example, 2050. You can also search for Choosing Vanguard Target Date Fund. Like most target date funds, these funds have very low fees. And best of all, they automatically reallocate over time, so you don't have to worry about rebalancing, which is buying and selling to maintain your target asset allocation. In short, they do all the hard work for you. All you have to do is contribute as much as possible. Now, a few notes you want to keep in mind as you research these funds. Some companies call them target date funds, while others call them target retirement or life cycle funds. They're all the same thing. Some companies require you to invest a minimum amount, usually $1,000 to $3,000, but that fee can often be waived if you agree to automatic investing, which you should. Finally, you can choose any target date fund depending on your age and risk tolerance. So if you're 25 and for some reason pretty risk averse, you can pick a fund designed for someone older, which will give you a more conservative asset allocation. Buying into your target date fund. Now that you've identified a target date fund to invest in, actually buying it is pretty easy. Log into your Roth IRA, which you opened in Chapter 3. Your login information will be handy if you use a tool like I suggested to track all your logins and passwords. You'll need to have at least enough cash in your Roth IRA to cover the minimum investment of the fund, which is usually between $1,000 and $3,000. Again, some companies waive the minimums if you set up automatic investments every month, which you should. But some, like Vanguard, won't waive the fees no matter what. If you really want a fund that requires a minimum investment and you don't have the money yet, no problem. Save up the necessary amount using a sub-savings account. Now, once you have enough money in the account, type in the ticker symbol for your target date fund. It will look something like VFINX. If you don't know it, you can search for it right from your account. Then you click buy. Voila! With each fund you buy, you'll be able to set up automatic contributions so you don't have to contribute manually each month. Jenna Christensen, who's 26 years old, wrote, "Since reading IWT, I have probably saved and earned at least $70,000 plus over the past 4 years. This was accomplished by reading the 401k and Roth IRA sections and investing in target date funds." The Rule of 72. The Rule of 72 is a fast trick you can do to figure out how long it will take you to double your money. Here's how it works. Divide the number 72 by the return rate you're getting, and you'll have the number of years you must invest in order to double your money. For the math geeks out there among us, here's the equation. 72 divided by return rate equals number of years. For example, if you're getting a 10% return rate from an index fund, it would take you a little more than 7 years, that's 72 divided by 10, to double your money. In other words, if you invested $5,000 today and you let it sit there, earning a 10% return, you'd have $10,000 in about 7 years. The magical part is that it doubles from there too. Of course, you could accumulate even more using the power of compounding by adding more every month. As a good rule of thumb, you should assume an 8% return. This small investing mistake cost her $9,000. An IWT reader wrote me about a conversation she had with her friend. The friend mentioned she'd been contributing to her Roth IRA for almost 10 years. And then she sent me this email describing the conversation. IWT reader, 10 years, wow, that's great. Friend, yeah, but it's barely increased at all. My IWT reader had a weird feeling in her stomach. IWT reader, you know you have to buy the funds, right? It's not enough to just transfer the money into an IRA. You have to choose the allocation. Friend, what? This reader then wrote me in all caps, Ramit, my friend has been putting money into a Roth for 10 years and never selected funds. It's a glorified savings account. She missed 10 years of investment growth with compound interest. I don't know if I'm more angry or sad. Do you see what's happening here? Her friend opened a Roth IRA, just like you did in Chapter 3, and even transferred the money over, but never took the final step, making sure that the money got invested. It's funny, very few experts are ever crystal clear in telling you that you need to actually invest your money once you send it over to your Roth IRA. And the worst part, the $3,000 her friend invested could have been worth more than $12,000. That's $9,000 in effortless money. And because it's a Roth, those earnings would have been tax-free. You know I had to ask how her friend felt when she learned the truth. The friend said, I feel kind of cheated. I could have been earning more money for all these years, yet no one ever told me about this important step. Guys, this is why I started writing about money. This woman went out of her way to get educated. She went as far as opening up a Roth IRA and even contributed thousands of dollars. But because she didn't understand the tiny technical features of this retirement account, she lost out on $9,000 of tax-free earnings. Now, should she take some responsibility for not knowing exactly how a Roth works? Yes, of course. But I have to tell you, it shouldn't be this hard. You shouldn't have to be a financial expert to have your money just do the right thing. Just like I shouldn't have to understand how a carburetor works to drive my car. A Roth IRA is just an account. Once your money is in there, you have to start investing in different funds to see your money grow. So do me a favor. Share this information with someone you know who's just getting started investing. We could literally help them earn thousands of dollars over the years. So you want to do it on your own. Okay, you aren't satisfied with one target date fund, and you want to pick your own index funds to construct your portfolio in your Roth IRA. First, just a question. Are you sure? If you're looking for one investment that gets you 85% of the way there, which you won't have to monitor, you won't have to rebalance, you won't even have to pay attention to, then just use a target date fund from the previous section. Can you tell that I'm a big target date fan? Remember, most people who try to manage their own portfolios fail at even matching the market. They fail because they sell at the first sign of trouble, or because they buy and sell too frequently, thereby diminishing their returns with taxes and trading fees. The result is tens of thousands of dollars lost over a lifetime. Plus, if you buy individual index funds, you'll have to rebalance every year to make sure your asset allocation is still where you want it to be. Target date funds do this for you, so if you just want an easy way to invest, use one. But if you want more control over your investments, and you just know that you're disciplined enough to withstand market dips and to take the time to rebalance your asset allocation at least once a year, then, and only then, choosing your own portfolio of index funds might be the right choice for you. All right, let's do this. If you've listened this far, I guess my warnings didn't dissuade you from building your own portfolio. If I can't scare you, I guess I might as well help you. As we discussed earlier, the key to constructing a portfolio is not picking killer stocks. It's actually figuring out a balanced asset allocation that will let you ride out storms and slowly grow, over time, to gargantuan proportions. To illustrate how to allocate and diversify your portfolio, we're going to use David Swensen's recommendation as a model. Swensen is pretty much the Beyonce of money management. He runs Yale's fabled endowment, and for more than 30 years, he's generated an astonishing 13.5% annualized return, whereas most managers can't even beat 8%. That means he's almost doubled Yale's money every 5 years from 1985 to today. Best of all, Swensen is a genuinely good guy. He could be making hundreds of millions each year running his own fund on Wall Street, but he chooses to stay at Yale because he loves academia. As he said, when I see colleagues of mine leave universities to do essentially the same thing they were doing, but to get paid more, I'm disappointed because there's a sense of mission. I love this guy. Swenson suggests allocating your money in the following way. 30% domestic equities. That means U.S. stock funds, including small, mid, and large cap stocks. 15% developed world international equities. These are funds from developed foreign countries, including the United Kingdom, Germany, and France. 5% emerging market equities. Funds from developing foreign countries such as China, India, and Brazil. These are riskier than developed world equities, so don't go off buying these to fill 95% of your portfolio. 20% real estate investment trusts, also known as REITs. REITs invest in mortgages and residential and commercial real estate, both domestically and internationally. 15% government bonds, fixed interest U.S. securities, which provide predictable income and balance risk in your portfolio. As an asset class, remember that bonds generally return less than stocks. And finally, 15% treasury inflation protected securities, also known as TIPS. These treasury notes protect against inflation. Eventually, you'll want to own these, but they'd be the last ones I'd get after investing in all the better returning options first. A significant amount of math went into Swenson's allocation, but the most important takeaway is that no single choice represents an overwhelming part of the portfolio. As we know, lower risk generally equals lower reward. But the coolest thing about asset allocation is that you can actually reduce your risk while maintaining an equivalent return. Swenson's theories are great, but how do we make them real? And how do we pick funds that match his suggestions? Well, the answer is by picking a portfolio of low-cost funds. That's how. Choosing your own index funds means you'll need to dig around and identify the best index funds for you. I always start researching at the most popular companies, Vanguard, Schwab, and T. Rowe Price, so check out their websites. When you visit these websites, you'll be able to research their funds to make sure they're low cost and meet your asset allocation goals. The first thing you want to do when picking funds is to minimize fees. Look for the management fees or expense ratios to be low, around 0.2%, and you'll be fine. Most of the index funds at Vanguard, T. Rowe Price, and Fidelity offer excellent value. Remember, expense ratios are one of the few things you can control, and higher fees cost you dearly. That money just goes straight to Wall Street's pocket. Second, you want to make sure the fund fits into your asset allocation. After all, the reason you're choosing your own index funds is to have more control over your investments. Use David Swenson's model as a baseline and tweak as necessary if you want to exclude certain funds or prioritize which are important for you. For example, if you have limited money and you're in your 20s, you probably want to buy the stock funds first so you can get their compounding power, whereas you can wait until you're older and have more money to buy the bond funds to mitigate your risk. In other words, when you look for various funds, make sure you're being strategic about your domestic equities, international equities, bonds, and all the rest. You cannot just pick random funds and expect to have a balanced asset allocation. To analyze your current portfolio, log into your investment account and use their tools. For example, I log into Vanguard and I can see what percentage of my portfolio is in equities versus bonds or international versus domestic. You can do the same for any fund you're considering. And every major investment company offers this. If it doesn't, you can use the online site Personal Capital. This is a great way to drill into your asset allocation and make sure your funds are well diversified. Third, note that you should absolutely look at how well the fund has returned over the last 10 or 15 years, but remember that, as they say, past performance is no guarantee of future results. To make this a little easier, most websites will have something called a fund screener available. This fund screener will let you add search filters, such as international index funds with an expense ratio of less than 0.75%, to find funds that fit your criteria. I know this is starting to sound complicated. That's the point. This isn't simple. Creating your portfolio takes significant research. As an example of what you might end up with, here's a sample portfolio made of all Vanguard funds. On the stock or equities side, 30% might be in the total market index/equities. That's VTSMX. 20% might be in the total international stock index / equities. That's VGTSX. And 20% might be in the REIT index / equities.